Chapter 10. Through the iron sides of the ship, Pat set all these bodies whirling like dust. There came to them a confused uproar, a tempestuous tumult, a fierce mutter, gusts of screams dying away, and the tramping of feet mingling with the blows of the sea. For a moment they glared amazed, blocking the doorway. Jukes pushed through them brutally. He said nothing, and simply darted inches another lot of coolies on the ladder, struggling suicidally to break through the battened hatch to a swamp deck, fell off as before, and he disappeared under them like a man overtaken by a landslide. The boatswain yelled excitedly, "Colin, come along. Get the mate out. He'll be trampled to death. Come on." They charged in, stamping on breasts, on fingers, on faces, catching their feet in heaps of clothing, kicking broken wood. But before they could get hold of him, Jukes emerged waist-deep in a multitude of clawing hands. In the instant he had been lost to view, all the buttons of his jacket had gone, its back had got split up to the collar, his waistcoat had been torn open. The central struggling mass of Chinamen went over to the roll, dark, indistinct, helpless, with a wild gleam of many eyes, in the dim light of the lamps. "Leave me alone, damn you. I am all right," screeched Jukes. "Drive them forward. Watch your chance when she pitches. Forward with them. Drive them against the bulkhead. Jam them up." The rush of the sailors into the seething tween deck was like a splash of cold water into a boiling cauldron. The commotion sank for a moment. The bulk of Chinamen were locked in such a compact scrimmage that, linking their arms and aided by an appalling dive of the ship, the seamen sent it forward in one great shove, like a solid block. Behind their backs, small clusters and loose bodies tumbled from side to side. The boatswain performed prodigious feats of strength. With his long arms open, and each great paw clutching at a stanchion, he stopped the rush of seven entwined Chinamen rolling like a boulder. His joints cracked, he said, "Ha!" And they flew apart. But the carpenter showed the greater intelligence. Without saying a word to anybody, he went back into the alleyway to fetch several coils of cargo gear he had seen there, chain and rope. With these, lifelines were rigged. There was really no resistance. The struggle, however it began, had turned into a scramble of blind panic. If the coolies had started up after their scattered dollars, they were by that time fighting only for their footing. They took each other by the throat, merely to save themselves from being hurled about. Whoever got a hold anywhere would kick at the others who caught at his legs and hung on, till a roll sent them flying together across the deck. The coming of the white devils was a terror. Had they come to kill? The individuals torn out of the ruck became very limp in the seamen's hands. Some, dragged aside by the heels, were passive, like dead bodies, with open, fixed eyes. Here and there a coolie would fall on his knees, as if begging for mercy. Several, whom the excess of fear made unruly, were hit with hard fists between the eyes, and cowered, while those who were hurt submitted to rough handling, blinking rapidly without a plaint. Faces streamed with blood. There were raw places on the shaven heads, scratches, bruises, torn wounds, gashes. The broken porcelain out of the chests was mostly responsible for the latter. Here and there a Chinaman, wild-eyed, with his tail unplaited, nursed a bleeding soul. They had been ranged closely, after having been shaken into submission, cuffed a little to allay excitement, addressed in gruff words of encouragement that sounded like promises of evil. They sat on the deck in ghastly, drooping rows, and at the end the carpenter, with two hands to help him, moved busily from place to place, setting taut and hitching the lifelines. The boatswain, with one leg and one arm embracing a stanchion, struggled with a lamp pressed to his breast, trying to get a light, and growling all the time like an industrious gorilla. The figures of seamen stooped repeatedly, with the movements of gleaners, and everything was being flung into the bunker. Clothing, smashed wood, broken china, and the dollars too, gathered up in men's jackets. Now and then a sailor would stagger towards the doorway with his arms full of rubbish, and dolorous, slanting eyes followed his movements. With every roll of the ship, the long rows of sitting celestials would sway forward brokenly, and her headlong dives knocked together the line of shaven poles from end to end. When the wash of water rolling on the deck died away for a moment, it seemed to Jukes, yet quivering from his exertions, that in his mad struggle down there he had overcome the wind somehow. That a silence had fallen upon the ship, a silence in which the sea struck thunderously at her sides. Everything had been cleared out of the tween deck, all the wreckage, as the men said. They stood erect and tottering above the level of heads and drooping shoulders. Here and there a coolie sobbed for his breath. Where the high light fell, Jukes could see the salient ribs of one, the yellow, wistful face of another, bowed necks, or would meet a dull stare directed at his face. He was amazed that there had been no corpses, but the lot of them seemed at their last gasp, and they appeared to him more pitiful than if they had been all dead. Suddenly one of the coolies began to speak. The light came and went on his lean, straining face. He threw his head up like a baying hound. From the bunker came the sounds of knocking and the tinkle of some dollars rolling loose. He stretched out his arm, his mouth yawned black, and the incomprehensible guttural hooting sounds, that did not seem to belong to a human language, penetrated Jukes with a strange emotion, as if a brute had tried to be eloquent. Two more started mouthing what seemed to Jukes fierce denunciations. The others stirred with grunts and growls. Jukes ordered the hands out of the tween decks hurriedly. He left last himself, backing through the door, while the grunts rose to a loud murmur and hands were extended after him, as after a malefactor. The boatswain shot the bolt, and remarked uneasily, "Seems as if the wind had dropped, sir." The seamen were glad to get back into the alleyway. Secretly each of them thought that at the last moment he could rush out on deck and that was a comfort. There is something horribly repugnant in the idea of being drowned under a deck. Now they had done with the Chinaman, they again became conscious of the ship's position. Jukes, on coming out of the alleyway, found himself up to the neck in the noisy water. He gained the bridge, and discovered he could detect obscure shapes, as if his sight had become preternaturally acute. He saw faint outlines. They recalled not the familiar aspect of the Nanshan, but something remembered an old dismantled steamer he had seen years ago rotting on the mudbank. She recalled that wreck. There was no wind, not a breath, except the faint currents created by the lurches of the ship. The smoke tossed out of the funnel was settling down upon her deck. He breathed it as he passed forward. He felt the deliberate throb of the engines, and heard small sounds that seemed to have survived the great uproar. The knocking of broken fittings, the rapid tumbling of some piece of wreckage on the bridge. He perceived dimly the squat shape of his captain holding onto a twisted bridge rail, motionless and swaying, as if rooted to the planks. The unexpected stillness of the air oppressed Jukes. "We have done it, sir," he gasped. "Thought you would," said Captain McWhirr. "Did you?" murmured Jukes to himself. "Wind fell all at once," went on the captain. Jukes burst out, "Colon, if you think it was an easy job," but his captain, clinging to the rail, paid no attention. "According to the books, the worst is not over yet. If most of them hadn't been half dead with seasickness and fright, not one of us would have come out of that tween deck alive," said Jukes. "Had to do what's fair by them," mumbled McWhirr, stolidly. "You don't find everything in books. Why, I believe they would have risen on us, if I hadn't ordered the hands out of that pretty quick," continued Jukes with warmth. After the whisper of their shouts, their ordinary tones, so distinct, rang out very loud to their ears, in the amazing stillness of the air. It seemed to them they were talking in a dark and echoing vault. Through a jagged aperture in the dome of clouds, the light of a few stars fell upon the black sea, rising and falling confusedly. Sometimes the head of a watery cone would topple on board and mingle with the rolling flurry of foam on the swamp deck, and the Nanshan wallowed heavily at the bottom of a circular cistern of clouds. This ring of dense vapors, gyrating madly around the comm of the center, encompassed the ship like a motionless and unbroken wall of an aspect inconceivably sinister. Within, the sea, as if agitated by an internal commotion, leaped in peak mounds that jostled each other, slapping heavily against her sides, and a low moaning sound, the infinite plaint of the storm's fury, came from beyond the limits of the menacing calm. Captain McWhirr remained silent, and Duke's ready ear caught suddenly the faint, long-drawn roar of some immense wave rushing unseen under that thick blackness, which made the appalling boundary of his vision. Of course, he started resentfully, they thought we had caught at the chance to plunder them. Of course. You said pick up the money. Easier said than done. They couldn't tell what was in our heads. We came in, smash right into the middle of them. Had to do it by a rush. As long as it's done. Dot mumbled the captain, without attempting to look at Jukes. Had to do what's fair. We shall find yet there's the devil, to pay when this is over, said Jukes, feeling very sore. Let them only recover a bit, and you will see. They will fly at our throats, sir. Don't forget, sir, she isn't a British ship now. These brutes know it well too. The damn Siamese flag. We are on board, all the same, remarked Captain McWhirr. The trouble's not over yet, insisted Jukes, prophetically, reeling and catching on. He's a wreck, he added, faintly. The trouble's not over yet, assented Captain McWhirr, half aloud. Look out for her a minute. Are you going off the deck, sir? Asked Jukes, hurriedly, as if the storm were sure to pounce upon him, as soon as he had been left alone with the ship. He watched her, battered and solitary, laboring heavily in the wild scene of mountainous black waters lit by the gleams of distant worlds. She moved slowly, breathing into the still core of the hurricane the excess of her strength in a white cloud of steam, and the deepened vibration of the escape was like the defiant trumpeting of a living creature of the sea impatient for the renewal of the contest. It ceased suddenly. The still air moaned. Above Juke's head a few stars shone into a pit of black vapors. The inky edge of the cloud disk frowned upon the ship under the patch of glittering sky. The stars, too, seemed to look at her intently, as if for the last time, and the cluster of their splendor sat like a diadem on a lowering brow. Captain McWhirr had gone into the chart room. There was no light there, but he could feel the disorder of that place, where he used to live tidily. His armchair was upset. The books had tumbled out on the floor. He scrunched a piece of glass under his boot. He groped for the matches, and found a box on a shelf with a deep ledge. He struck one, and puckering the corners of his eyes, held out the little flame towards the barometer whose glittering top of glass and metals nodded at him continuously. It stood very low, incredibly low, so low that Captain McWhirr grunted. The match went out, and hurriedly he extracted another, with thick, stiff fingers. Again a little flame flared up before the nodding glass and metal of the top. His eyes looked at it, narrowed with attention, as if expecting an imperceptible sign. With his grave face he resembled a booted and misshapen pagan burning incense before the oracle of a joss. There was no mistake. It was the lowest reading he had ever seen in his life. Captain McWhirr emitted a low whistle. He forgot himself till the flame diminished to a blue spark, burnt his fingers and vanished. Perhaps something had gone wrong with the thing. There was an aneroid glass screwed above the couch. He turned that way, struck another match, and discovered the white face of the other instrument looking at him from the bulkhead, meaningly, not to be gainsaid, as though the wisdom of men were made unerring by the indifference of matter. There was no room for doubt now. Captain McWhirr sawed at it, and threw the match down. The worst was to come, then, and if the books were right, this worst would be very bad. The experience of the last 6 hours had enlarged his conception of what heavy weather could be like. It'll be terrific, he pronounced, mentally. He had not consciously looked at anything by the light of the matches except at the barometer, And yet somehow he had seen that his water bottle and the two tumblers had been flung out of their stand. It seemed to give him a more intimate knowledge of the tossing the ship had gone through. Wouldn't have believed it, he thought. And his table had been cleared too. His rulers, his pencils, the inkstand, all the things, that at their safe appointed places they were gone, as if a mischievous hand had plucked them out one by one, and flung them on the wet floor. The hurricane had broken in upon the orderly arrangements of his privacy. This had never happened before, and the feeling of dismay reached the very seat of his composure. And the worst was to come yet. He was glad the trouble in the tween deck had been discovered in time. If the ship had to go after all, then, at least, she wouldn't be going to the bottom with a lot of people in her fighting teeth and claw. That would have been odious. And in that feeling there was a humane intention, and a vague sense of the fitness of things. These instantaneous thoughts were yet in their essence heavy and slow, partaking of the nature of the man. He extended his hand to put back the matchbox in its corner of the shelf. There were always matches there by his order. The steward had his instructions impressed upon him long before. Box. Dot dot just there, see? Not so very full. Dot dot where I can put my hand on it, steward. Might want daylight in a hurry. Can't tell on board ship what you might want in a hurry. Mind, now. And of course on his side he would be careful to put it back in its place scrupulously. He did so now, but before he removed his hand it occurred to him that perhaps he would never have occasion. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.